Welcome to Tastes of the Tropics. And now, here are your hosts, Gretchen Schmidt and Christina Favretto.
Welcome to Tastes of the Tropics. My name is Gretchen Schmidt. I'm with Edible South Florida magazine. We explore our foods, our stories, our community by season.
I'm Christina Favretto, a food-loving librarian who's also a culinary historian.
Welcome to our podcast. We've got our Miami Book Fair in town, and we are delighted to bring here all the way from
Seattle.
Okay. Mie Leip. She has written a wonderful, comprehensive telephone book-sized book called Bounty from the Box, the CSA Farm Cookbook. Now, we got our hands on it several months ago. I think it was in the spring. And
I don't want to take my hands off it because it is filled with fascinating recipes, beautifully designed, very readable. It's the kind of cookbook, you open it to a certain page, it stays open, you can glance down while you're cooking. So it's design-wise, it's great, but it's the recipes that are fabulous.
Well, that's true, and the stories. And I have to preface this by saying, when Mie first contacted us with this book, and we looked at it, and we said, we're here in South Florida. CSA, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture, is still a relatively new concept down here. Farmers markets are common elsewhere in the U.S., but in South Florida, I would have to say only in the last 5 years have we begun to see farmers markets, and as you have found out, they may not look like what you're used to seeing all over the country. So, with that in mind, welcome, Mie, and tell us a little bit. You've been here for a week now in South Florida. It is fall, which is the kickoff of our growing season, which is completely different from how it is up north.
That is correct, yes. And thank you for having me. It has been an adventure being here. Florida is a bit of a paradox because it is so lush. You would think it grows a lot of fruits and vegetables, but not a lot of it you can find locally. And that is an interesting paradox that I have not come across before.
It's true. We're embracing local foods. We want to, but we have to understand how to do it. And we have another interesting factor. We, as you've noticed, we have a real diverse community here, and it's always changing, very transient. So we have a huge Hispanic community, but that's really can be broken down into, you know, obviously Cuban, but Nicaraguan and Venezuelan, and on and on and on. And then we have folks from everywhere else in the Northeast. And of course, typically they come down here, and we hear this question a lot, like, well, we went to the farmers markets and we didn't see the apples. Or in the middle of July, they're looking for strawberries. And the truth is, we don't grow strawberries here. We grow them in January. Tell us a little bit about, in the course of writing the book, some of the discoveries that made you perhaps change what you were writing about here, CSA adapting it for places like where we live here. I know Hawaii also has different.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, the adventure of writing the book, it was kind of in two different parts. One was to write it as a cookbook from the food perspective, the crops. There's about 100 different crops represented, so that's a huge range. But I also travel to Hawaii quite regularly, and I was actually there that I got interested in the tropical farmers market scene because it is extremely different what is offered between there and the rest of the country. Same thing with Florida. So the growing seasons are opposite, as you know, and it's, you know, your season starts here in October, November, and ends right at the beginning of what would be the prime growing season for pretty much the rest of the country, and I find that fascinating. So
you actually mentioned that you've also been to Europe as part of this book tour?
Europe is separate from that, actually.
Okay, so, because I was going to ask about, we can edit this, but the CSA, is that concept catching on, or did it catch on to us from them?
Actually, it caught on, I think, more from them. Actually, in Europe and Japan was actually really where CSAs got started back in the late 70s, 80s, and then it sort of caught on from there to here. And actually, it became a part of Canada, kind of much more before it migrated south to the United States.
What would be in a typical CSA box this month in New York State, in California, and then in Florida?
Well, I would say that probably New York, there's not much going on. They're wrapping up their season about now, but You know, typically in the more northern states, it would be a lot of winter crops, things like parsnips, carrots, root vegetables, potatoes, garlic, certainly. More of those kind of traditional winter root cellar type vegetables. In Florida, we're starting to see the greens, the really succulent new kale, a lot of the newer greens, a few fruits emerging, but not too much. A few brassicas, some peppers, okra certainly in season now. The radishes are beautiful too at this time of the year, so seeing some encouraging signs. As far as California, well, California tends to be sort of a grab bag. A lot of things are available at different times because of their seasons are staggered tremendously, and there's a huge mix between the larger commercial markets for farmers markets and the smaller growers, so there is tremendous diversity there. Hard to kind of pin that one down.
What do you think that South Florida isn't growing that it could be growing?
Now, that's a million-dollar question. Not being so locally from here, not being so familiar with the growing season, it's hard for me to answer that from a farming perspective, but I think from an eating perspective, I've seen a real kind of a disconnect between conversations between farmers and the public. I think the public do a better job of just going to farmers markets and shopping at them, educating themselves about what farmers can grow, maybe asking farmers to grow certain things or to have more of a discourse, really, between the farmer and the consumer. I think there needs to be a lot more of that happening between both sides, and that, you know, consumers need to take that step forward to shop locally and visit their farmers market. And, you know, what I'm finding is farmers markets are really a place of discovery. I think a lot of consumers don't really realize that what they're missing out on.
What would you say to people who have the perception that farmers market offerings are more expensive and therefore more prohibitive for their budget?
Well, you know, there are many considerations. One thing is that farmers markets, many of them do offer EBT or SNAP benefits, so those are food stamps. So that should not be a barrier now for people who need to use their food budget using those. One of the biggest, you know, arguments that people do, rightfully so, talk about is, you know, they perceive organic or local food as being more expensive. But the overall, the biggest problem is that in this country, we've been used to big agriculture, large-scale farming operations being subsidized with commodity crops like wheat, corn, soybeans, which have cheapened the prices of our food profoundly. So the net result of that is that none of us actually really know how much it costs to grow our food, and so we are used to food at just artificially ridiculously low prices. I would argue that, you know, our bodies and our health, if you don't have your health, then nothing else matters. And our health is directly tied to nutrition, and how do you put a price on that? So I understand that people have limited budgets, but I really do believe that priorities all being equal, you know, if you really value your health and your well-being and that of your children, your family, that, you know, that you have a decision to be able to spend a little bit more to put good food and nutritious food into your...
One of the issues that we've seen with CSAs, when people sign up for them, and it is a commitment, you're taking on the burden or bounty of the farmer by investing in them, is that people receive a box, especially at the beginning of the season, when really and truly we don't have tomatoes until early winter. Right now we start getting squash and lots of greens and some other things they grow, some other unusual leaves and flavorings, and they'll throw those in the CSA box. And the smart CSA farmers include recipes and guidelines and things to do with these. But it's really a radical difference from how we shop, because typically you go to the supermarket, you're going back for the same stuff over and over again, things you're comfortable with. When you wrote this cookbook, sounds to me like you were really encouraging people to, it's really taking a bit of a risk, not just a financial risk, but oh my gosh, we've got, you know, even before kale became really popular, like you get abundant amounts of kale, and sometimes 3 and 4 weeks in a row. you're obliged to cook with this or waste it. So your cookbook sounds to me like you set out to, like, here's what you do with all that.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, the biggest challenge when you get a CSA box that you don't have really much control over is, like, what on earth do I do with all this produce? And even a very basic question, what is it that I'm getting here? And so I really wrote the book to be kind of that crucial missing link between farmers and eaters. Consumers, especially if they order a CSA box, they really want to try new things. They want to eat better. But, you know, we all need help because we all get into ruts and bad habits. You know, we tend to cook carrots or peas maybe the same two or three ways. And I really wanted to introduce people to produce in a whole different way. So the book contains very specific information on how to cook, store, freeze, things in very different ways. There's lists of complementary foods as well, and serving suggestions. And this is in addition to the 360 recipes that are in the book. And the idea behind a lot of these is just, you know, that if you don't have all the ingredients in your pantry or fridge for a specific recipe, and how many of us actually do, that you can look at the complementary food lists or the serving suggestions and just get ideas right away about something that you probably do have in your kitchen right now, tonight, and get an idea for a different taste combination or pairing.
Well, I'm looking at avocados right now, something that we do have in South Florida, and I see not only a really great and accessible history of avocados, tips for cleaning, trimming, ripening, but also unusual recipes, Indonesian avocado and chocolate shake, which I'd love to try immediately, and California avocado hummus and dark chocolate avocado cookies. Then you have also a sidebars with books about avocados. Then you have websites about avocados.
I told you it was comprehensive. I love it. This is the best part about it.
It's comprehensive, but at the same time, it's not intimidating.
No, the fact that you, and also this is another good thing. Okay, so let's say we did something a couple years ago in the magazine on strange foods. Okay, strange, obviously they're not strange at all, but kohlrabi is something that's, you know,
right.
You look at that and you're like, boy, oh boy, God did have a sense of humor when he made that. That it just looks like an alien thing. And people like it, and it's very beautiful and very, you know, purple, bright green, whatever. But I don't know that people bought it. They're interested in it. But, you know, do you find that people are just, they're too
right,
safe. They don't
exactly.
want to, you know, like, well, and what do I do? Do I peel it? Do I steam it? And your book, you really told them what to do. Do I freeze it? You've got mm-hmm. information on every single CSA kind of piece of produce
simple.
Here. Yeah.
And who wouldn't want to make polka dot clouds? I won't go into
what
that.
What is it?
I'm not saying because people should just get the book.
Huh.
And their children will love them because I can look at this recipe and know that any child or adult will love to have polka dot clouds.
Huh. What is it?
You would just have to get the book and
I guess out. So. What was the most challenging part of writing this book? It really is a big volume, by the way, and there's so much love in it, and it's all in tasty chunks, to use a terrible metaphor there, but I mean, it's like it's very inviting. Tell me some of the challenges in putting this together.
Well, the challenges of putting together a 700-page book are many. I can tell you, though, that many of them were just really enjoyable labors of love. One of them was certainly in doing the research for this, aside from the food. The book is kind of a way of raising public awareness about farming and food issues. And so over the course of the years that it took to do this, I and a couple of research assistants, we researched about 400 different farms and food-related organizations around the country. And what we were looking to do was to kind of paint a portrait of CSA farms and scenes throughout the country as a whole, just to get an idea. And what we were not expecting was just the diverse range of community-supported agriculture farms and the amazing work that these farms are doing throughout the country, not just in raising food, but really giving people hope. A couple of examples are a farm in Phoenix, for instance, that is giving political refugees who are seeking asylum from other countries, people who have come from an agrarian background, literally giving these people a second chance at starting life in a completely new country by growing the foods of their homelands and giving them a footing in this new country. Another was an organic farm that was actually started in the back of a cancer treatment hospital. Again, this is in Arizona, but the idea was that the executive chef of this cancer treatment center, he really sees the benefit of nutrition for cancer patients, the patients who need these nutrients the most. And so he, along with the support of this cancer treatment center, were able to get 25 acres behind the hospital planted with organic produce that actually the patients themselves, they can go out and help volunteer and tend the gardens as well. There's another farm in Seattle that actually does not have a set farm plot, but they actually go out in the neighborhoods in Seattle and they recruit people in the neighborhood to use unused backyard space to cultivate food for the local neighborhood, and all that food stays in the community. So these are just a few of the fascinating stories that that we came across in researching this book, and I'm trying to kind of bring that together in this book. I think the stories are amazing, and in a time when media is really focusing a lot on bad news and a lot of terrible things in the world, this really, researching the book and finding these stories, it really restores the faith in humanity to really do good.
Now, you undertook this yourself, and you drove out here because I saw your car. So you really are. I mean, this must be a personal passion of yours.
It is, yes. I'm certainly not in it for the money here, but and really, my desire was that I really wanted to help both eaters and also the farms, because one of the biggest problems with farms is they have a hard time retaining a demand for their food. And as much as people want to do the right thing, they want to eat local, they want to eat better, people on all sides kind of just need help. And so the book was really something that I wanted to create to try to help that, a better, more functional food ecosystem to come along. And if I can play that small part, so be it here.
Okay. And were there revelations for you? For example, was there a vegetable that you didn't think you'd like that you suddenly discovered, wow, if I cook it this way, yum? Or, do you have a favorite story of some sort of discovery?
Oh, boy, that's a tough question. You know, people ask me all the time if I have a favorite vegetable or fruit, and I always say it's like asking an artist, what color is their favorite? I'm not sure that right off the top of my head I have a...
Sorry. Okay, we'll help you there. Yeah. We'll help you there. So you went to Hawaii. I don't know if you had any this week when you were here in South Florida, but some of the tropical fruits that we have here, I don't know, Canistella has been in season, if you've tried that
yes,
one.
Yes, I do have tried that.
Okay.
Actually, the one green vegetable that I did not know about before coming here was Minotina. I had simply never heard of it.
we're
That's what my brother used to call
here.
Me, yes. But yeah. No,
apparently,
you're
what is it?
Yes, apparently it is in the plantain family. Huh. The plantain, not of the banana family, but it's of the small low-lying weed with the flat leaves, the plantains. But it's in that family. I've since done a little research and found that's actually popular in Europe, including in Italy.
Minotina.
Minotina, yes, it's kind of a small, bushy plant. I've seen it growing at Little River CSA, but it's a plant that grows maybe about 7 or 8 inches tall. Has kind of narrow leaves. It looks a little bit like a very diminutive lacinato kale, I guess, but it looks kind of even different from that, a little bit like a very narrow leaf chicory.
Huh.
But the leaves are kind of fleshy. They have a most pleasing little bite and crunch to them. And you can eat it raw in salads, but actually I think it's best prepared just lightly stir-fried because it retains its crunch.
Uh-huh.
But it has a lovely nutty flavor to it. And it's something I highly recommend, and I've never seen it outside of Florida.
Well, I've never heard of that, and Christina is Italian,
they're revoking part of my Italian heritage. I've never heard of Minutina. But on that vein, what are some vegetables that you think could require an overhaul in regards to how we use them and how we perceive them? You know, kale is cooked in certain ways, for example, or you also mentioned flowers, edible flowers.
Edible flowers, that's quite a topic. You know, there's been a lot of press paid to edible flowers. Certainly many of us, if we go out to higher end restaurants, we see nasturtiums, mm-hmm. Maybe the flowers of pansies, of violets, roses, for instance. But, you know, it's interesting because there's actually a lot of just kind of regular flowers like gladiolus, for instance. They have a mild flavor. They taste a little bit like lettuce.
Can you eat the stem?
I don't think so. I think it's really more the flower part. But, you know, gladiolus are very big, showy flowers. They mm-hmm. come in all different colors, and they are just gorgeous, just scattered, you know, into a salad. Most of the flowers, actually, of our common fruits and vegetables actually are edible, with a few exceptions. But
oleander, you give them to someone you don't like.
No. Yes, oleander is, oleander is quite poisonous, even though it is actually used medicinally, but we do not recommend that here.
Squash flowers have always been used in cooking.
Yes.
There's an Italian thing that I do. And yes, and what they do in the United States is bad because they fill it with cheeses and they take away the delicate flavor, but it's
good,
the flavor blossom, right?
Right. In Florida, since you're the home of citrus, actually citrus flowers are just delicious. Oh. So a little bit goes a long ways, especially with orange blossoms or lemon trees. Again, the flowers will mimic the taste of the citrus fruit. A little bit goes a long way, so don't overdo it, but they're wonderful in like teas and a few petals just tossed into salad. Carnations are also edible, too.
Well, our time is up on our podcast. Obviously, we could keep going long, long time here. So you're just going to have to pick up this beautiful book. It's called Bounty from the Box, the CSA Farm Cookbook. Tell us where you can get it, Mia.
Yes. So locally around in the Miami area, you can get it at Books and Books. And also, you can order it directly from my website, which is bountyfromthebox.com. We're also on Facebook, Pinterest, Twitter, and Instagram. So look for us, Bounty from the Box.
Well, we certainly will. You've been listening to Tastes of the Tropics on Edible Radio. This is Gretchen Schmidt of Edible South Florida.
Christina Favretto, University of Miami Special Collections, and Culinary Historiana Everywhere.
Well, listen for more food conversations on our future podcast. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Tastes of the Tropics with Gretchen Schmidt and Christina Favretto on Edible Radio. For more information or to listen to archives, visit ediblefeast.com. This podcast is a production of Edible Radio, all rights reserved.